just days into 2018 and already trouble for two lawmakers.
Under the Senate sexual harassment policy, at the very least, whether he did it or not, he says, well, I didn't pursue it because there was no formal complaint and I knew I didn't do anything. But by the rules, if you hear something, you have to report it.
And just in time for the beginning of a new year at the Capitol.
I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill.
Matt Hamilton of the Times Union explains how to get legislation passed in Albany. It's next on New York Now, right here on PBS.
Funding for New York Now is provided by WNET. Additional funding provided by the Leo Cox Beach Philanthropic Foundation. Winner of a New York State Emmy for Best Political Program, this is New York Now.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to New York Now. I'm Matt Ryan.
And I'm Casey Seiler from the Times Union. Well, 2018 is off to a very fast start.
We started off with allegations of misconduct.
Wednesday afternoon, a conference call was unexpectedly scheduled by independent Democratic Conference Senators Jeff Klein and Diane Savino, who addressed an allegation that would be coming out later in the afternoon by HuffPost. In the story, a former IDC staffer accused Klein of forcibly kissing her outside a bar in Albany hours after the passage of the state budget in 2015. Klein and Savino, who have been a couple for a number of years, were both adamant that the allegation was false.
I want to be crystal clear. This alleged incident never happened, nor did anything inappropriate happen in any fashion that evening, period.
To insinuate that it would have occurred in front of me, and those of you who know me know, I would not have remained silent. There would have been an incident that night had this occurred in full view of myself.
Governor Cuomo came out with a statement Wednesday night saying he agreed with Klein that the situation should be investigated immediately and independently. John Flanagan, in a release statement on the following day, said the matter is not within the jurisdiction of the Senate. We'll discuss this more at the Reporters Roundtable. Earlier in the week, Assemblywoman Pamela Harris of New York City was charged by the U.S. Attorney in Brooklyn with wire fraud, making false statements, and witness tampering in an 11-count indictment. She is accused of multiple schemes both before and while she served as a state lawmaker, including fraudulently claiming that Superstorm Sandy forced her out of her Brooklyn home, where she is accused of wrongly keeping $25,000 from FEMA. Speaker Carl Hastie reacted on Tuesday.
I don't want to get so much into it because, like I said, I don't know. I haven't read the indictment and things like that. But there's certain things that you can and cannot do in this life. And I'm not quite sure another ethics reform makes this better or worse. There's just things you're just not supposed to do in this life.
Harris was elected as an assemblywoman in 2015. At a press conference less than an hour after the story broke, Senate Majority Leader John Flanagan learned of the news from New York One reporter Zach Fink.
You've heard a lot of the talk in Albany today about another indictment, this time in the assembly. I'm curious if you think anything more should be done in the way the judge, Pamela Harris, in the assembly. Should anything more be done in the way of ethics reform, and were you surprised not to hear much of a mention in that in the State of the State last week?
You know what? I am uninformed for the moment. I was not aware of what you're discussing. I'm actually very disheartened to hear that.
Thursday, members of Governor Cuomo's administration unveiled the 2018 Women's Agenda for New York. It includes policies to combat sexual harassment in the workplace, codify Roe v. Wade into the state's constitution, and allow for the removal of firearms from domestic abusers. Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul and Secretary to the Governor Melissa DeRosa both spoke at the event.
Members of our administration traveled the state. We heard your voices, the voices of the women of New York, and your opinions, experiences, and needs. We discussed the barriers we face, confront the concerns you worry about, and the way we in government can respond to change them.
Because of the women who came out of the shadows and were bold enough to say something happened to me and the others who said, and me too, we have changed the discourse and how we view women forever.
And finally, back to the Senate Republicans. They met with reporters to unveil a series of tax breaks, including a 25% increase in property rebate checks and freezing school taxes for seniors. The conference, which controls the chamber by a slim majority, faced questions from reporters on how they would pay for the programs.
Obviously, the state has a $4.4 billion deficit going into the year. You talk about freezing property taxes for seniors and then phasing it out over 10 years. What's the money to do this?
Well, a couple of different things. First of all, we're making continued smart investments by doing things on a phase-in basis. We're not being cavalier. We're not acting overnight.
All right, let's turn the conversation now over to my partner from the Times Union, Casey Seiler, who is at our reporters' roundtable.
All right, we're not even 2 weeks into the legislative session, and we've had enough scandal for, well, a month. To help make sense of it, here at the reporters' roundtable, I am happy to be joined by Ken Lovett from the Daily News and Keisha Klukey, who covers education for Politico New York. All right, so let's dig into the allegations against Jeff Klein and the political ripples that are likely to come from it. Klein, as we saw, you know, denies this allegation that he forcibly kissed a staffer at the end of March 2015, and on Thursday sent a letter to Jay Cope, the state's ethics watchdog, asking for them to do an investigation.
After the governor, Andrew Stu Cousins, the Senate Democratic leader, and others called for an investigation. Klein did say when he announced that this story was coming that he's open to any investigation. It is not good for them. This is something that could, if something happens to Klein, if more allegations come forward or this proves to be true, you know, it could really not only impact him, but the existence of the his independent Democratic conference.
And what's really interesting is that all of the facts are the same in the story with the exception of the kiss. And I thought it was really interesting that she put her name on it. I mean, she's willing to stake her name on it.
Erica Vladimir.
So yeah. I think that really gives some sort of a strength to her claim. And then what we saw later on, specifically yesterday, was talking about who will do the investigation, because it needs to be independent, and there's no, Senator Flanagan had said there's no mechanism in the Senate to do an independent.
Didn't that surprise you to learn that there is apparently no mechanism? The Assembly has one, which is basically that the Ethics Committee, which is not perfect, we've discussed it at this table before, but they basically farm out the investigation to a hired investigator. That apparently doesn't exist in the Senate.
Well, the Senate does have it. They claim, though, that you need a formal complaint.
That's like Simon. Isn't that like Simon Says?
And that was never brought. And yeah, I mean, it is, you know, in this day and age especially, to put out a statement. And John Flanagan was all over the place, the Senate Majority Leader, when he put out the statement. He praised Jeff Klein, said we don't tolerate sexual harassment and we want people to come forward, but we can't look into it. There's two things, I think, too, that really raises the questions about the validity in terms of being on her side, which is the day after the alleged incident took place in 2015, Klein admitted that another staffer came up to him in his office and said, hey, there's a rumor that you kissed Erica. So, you know, why would, you know, at the time of the incident, obviously it was going around. She was telling people. She said she told a friend who corroborated that with the Huffington Post. So why would she be doing that, you know, unless it really happened?
Well, you also noted, you and Glenn Blaine noted that Klein is almost certainly a mandatory reporter for something like that if they hear a rumor floating around.
Yeah, that they should, under the Senate sexual harassment policy, at the very least, whether he did it or not, he says, well, I didn't pursue it because there was no formal complaint and I knew I didn't do anything. But by the rules, if you hear something, you have to report it. And whether, in his case, it would be to the Secretary of the Senate, but he did not do that. The other thing, too, is Erica Vladimir, she put out a Facebook post in October when the Harvey Weinstein situation was unfolding, and she basically said, I hope to find the strength where I can tell my story and help people tell theirs.
The potential kumbaya moment, the reconciliation of mainline Democrats and the IDC, is hoped for perhaps later in the session. Keisha, is this going to complicate that? Is Andrew Stewart Cousins going to want to kind of be co-leaders with someone who Jacob investigation's taking a long time is likely to be under this cloud for a while?
Yeah. Well, I think it really depends on, number one, do more allegations come out? Because that's what really corroborated a lot of the other cases, Harvey Weinstein, and really created this moment. So I think that will depend on, and also depends on Klein. If Klein goes down, I don't think, and I think Ken has said this a number of times, the IDC without Klein, is it really the IDC? I don't know. At this point in time, Democrats in the Senate are kind of going, oh, well, he's not one of ours. You know, he is the siding with the Republicans, and they're kind of using that moment to sort of distance themselves. So I don't know what that means in terms of the Kumbaya moment.
And I asked their spokespeople whether or not this affects their desire to form a leadership coalition, and they didn't have a response. So they're probably trying to figure it out as well. Mm-hmm.
So the allegations against Klein happened on Wednesday, came to light on Wednesday, only 2 days after the latest indictment of a sitting lawmaker, Pamela Harris, assemblywoman from Brooklyn, charged with defrauding several programs, including those that aided victims of Superstorm Sandy.
Right. She used the money on personal trips and lingerie and all sorts of things. It's not exactly a new situation in Albany. We've seen this, you know, a million times, it seems. But last year I did a story on Pam Harris that she had filed for personal bankruptcy, and she wasn't adhering to the bankruptcy court's agreement, so they were going to crack down on her on that. And as part of that, interesting, the not-for-profit she headed before she became an assemblywoman was using her home address as a as its mailing address, and she said they were paying her rent, but she wasn't reporting it anywhere. So that's also an issue.
The assembly is already looking at 11 empty chairs. It's pretty likely that Pamela Harris will not be fully locked in on her legislative duties. You know, it kind of increases the tension to get some of these special elections out of the way, correct?
Yeah. Well, and a lot of, they haven't been scheduled, correct? Are we,
right.
We're still waiting,
we're
on
still
Cuomo
waiting on governor.
To do that.
And
so.
The governor has said he wants to wait to hold them till after the budget because the deal with the IDC and the Senate Dems is contingent on these special elections, and he doesn't want to mess with the budget process.
Speaking of the budget process, we are just days away from the executive budget proposal, the unveiling of it on Tuesday by the governor. Keisha, what are you going to be looking for from that
well,
big package?
Well, I think that nothing's changed. Even though there is a deficit, nothing's changed. We're still looking at the foundation aid formula, the school aid formula, and will he move to phase it in fully, which is, I believe, $4.2 billion owed to school districts statewide, according to advocates in the education department. We don't have $4.2 billion at this point. There is that much and more in deficit. So that'll be interesting. At this point last year, if you'll recall, when he put out his executive budget, it actually didn't have the phase in. It eliminated the formula and would have set the 16-17 or the 17-18 as the base. And so that kind of had angered advocates. Excuse me. I think this year, in lieu of the budget deficit, it'll really just be about maintaining and holding flat. So maybe like a $1.3 million increase moving from there. But also, as you're increasing education aid, looking at healthcare and that sort of side of the budget, which is the other large chunk. And we're hearing that there's going to be a lot of competition between the two.
And the healthcare unions are going to put a $6 million ad campaign to make sure they get theirs. Also, what he does in addressing the tax reform bill from the federal government, how he plans to change that and fill the deficit hole at the same time.
All right. Well, that's where we're going to have to leave it. So thanks very much to Ken Lovett from The Daily News and Keisha Klucki from Politico New York. All right, with lawmakers back in Albany, we thought it would be a good time for a primer or perhaps a reminder on how a bill actually becomes a law. Your guide to this sometimes complicated process is my colleague from the Times Union, Matt Hamilton.
I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. Well, it's a long, long journey to the capital city. It's a long, long wait while I'm sitting in committee.
This is just a bill, one of nearly 16,000 introduced in 2017. During the 2015-16 legislative session, more than 18,500 total were introduced. New York lawmakers aren't alone in pumping out a high volume of legislation annually, though various state legislative bill trackers have shown in recent years that the Empire State ranks near the top in the nation annually in bills introduced. How many of those bills become a law is a different story, though. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. Before a bill can become the law of the land, somebody has to come up with the idea.
Often it's more the germ of an idea, and then we work with our counsel and our program, our analysts, to really learn more. We vet a lot of things before we ever get to the drafting stage.
The idea in any initial draft comes here. It's the Legislative Bill Drafting Commission. Employees provide advice where needed and maintain drafts. In the old days, the print shop would have to crank out paper copies of bills for every member of the legislature. Since the legislature has been paperless since 2015, copies are provided only upon request, and those with the requisite political support end up on a committee agenda. Frankly, it's a boring pro forma process, but there is the opportunity for political showmanship. Both the Assembly and Senate have rules outlining how a member can make a motion for committee consideration. For example, if a member of the Senate Democratic minority wanted to get Republican colleagues on record about a bill they might not otherwise put on the committee agenda, that Democrat could file a motion to bring the bill up for a vote, likely one that kills it before it ever reaches the floor. But those bills that move swiftly through committee must head to the Capitol's third floor. Bills can be passed first from either the Senate or the Assembly. In this case, let's say a bill starts here in the state Senate. Legislation that is aged for 3 days can be added to the day's active list and can come up for a vote. In some cases, the governor sends up what's called a message of necessity, which allows the bill to be voted on immediately. But before we even get to the voting process, politics comes into play. Not only is having a majority good for passing what you want on the floor, but the majorities of each house get to decide what actually is considered. So, even if a bill passed in committee, that doesn't mean it's going to come up for a vote. In 2017, 597 bills were reported to the calendar in either house, but not approved. Rarely does a bill that actually comes up for a vote fail. Instead, when passage seems uncertain, a bill is simply set aside. There have been two notable failures of legislation on the floor in the past decade. In 2009, same-sex marriage legislation went down. In 2014, the DREAM Act was defeated. Outliers aside, often the fate of legislation is predetermined, which means from here, we go to the state assembly to begin the process all over again. Voting happens here in the state assembly in a similar preordained fashion, but each house does have its quirks. For example, Speaker Carl Hastie and the Democratic majority have a rule that only bills with 76 Democratic supporters will get off the ground. That means that even if a bill has 76 votes in favor of it, that doesn't guarantee its passage. As in the Senate, legislation often passes by an overwhelming margin in the Assembly. Though a vote along party lines here, where more than 100 of the 150 members are Democrats, makes for an overwhelming margin, even in the more fractured state Senate, legislation often passes with more than the 32 votes needed. And now we wait. It's up to the House that originally passed the bill, in our case the Senate, to send it to the governor. In the old days, reams of bills would be dumped on his desk all at once. In modern times, the legislature and executive coordinate to send up batches of bills at any given time, particularly between July and December, when the legislature is out of session. Once a bill hits the desk, the governor has 10 days, excluding Sundays, to act. He has three options. He can sign it, he can veto it, or he can let it automatically become law. Pocket vetoes do exist in New York, but only in rare instances when the 10-day period ends after a legislative session is concluded. In other words, if a bill is sent to the governor on December 31st, he actually gets 30 days to act on it. If he doesn't take action, the bill is vetoed. Governors are not shy about using the veto pen, but even if legislators passed a bill that he vetoes overwhelmingly, overrides are rare. Two-thirds of the members of each house must vote to override a veto, but an override vote hasn't taken place during Governor Andrew Cuomo's 2 terms in office.
legislatures as a whole and legislators individually don't want to necessarily get into a long-term war with governors who have so much sway over the budget. But there's a political dimension too. Not since Nelson Rockefeller, for the single year of 1966, has a governor not had at least one house controlled by his party. And someday it'll be her party when we have a female governor. So I think those reasons merge together, and the legislature does not jump to say, we're gonna override a gubernatorial veto.
Out of the thousands of ideas that generated the 16,000 bills in 2017, only 606 were passed by both houses of the legislature. A majority of those were signed into law by the governor, including this bill, which bans the use of e-cigarettes indoors. The joyous end of a lengthy legislative process. Reporting from the state capitol, I'm Matt Hamilton.
The good news is, if you didn't quite get all that, you can head to our website, nynow.org. to watch it again. While you're there, you can not only see this week's episode, but any of our past productions. There are links to follow us on social media as well, including Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, where our handle is at NYNOW_PBS. You'll find a link to the Capitol Confidential blog run by Casey, Matt Hamilton, and other reporters at the Times Union. You can view it also by going to TimesUnion.com. This week's New York Now poll question asks, should the Senate Ethics Committee investigate Jeff Klein, or do you think it should be an independent body? Let us know by going to our website. Last week we asked, what did you think of Governor Cuomo's state of the states? And 65% said they didn't like it. Wendy in Ossining, watching on WNET, said, I'm a lifelong Democrat, but did not vote for Cuomo because of his stand on education. I believe he is preparing to run for president, and I like that he's going more to the left. Also happy that he is taking on Trump. Gary on Long Island, watching on WLIW, the governor needs to address and talk about what he did and his actions and plans for improving New York state affairs first before throwing rocks at the federal government. And finally, Joanne in Putnam County told us, Mr. Cuomo should have been charged for commercial time, as this was clearly a bid for the next presidential election. As always, thanks for taking the time to vote, and we hope to hear from you again by voting at nynow.org.
Steven Spielberg's acclaimed new drama, The Post, opens nationwide this weekend, telling the story of the Washington Post's decision to publish the Pentagon Papers in the face of considerable legal peril. The main characters, played in the movie by Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks, are Post publisher Katherine Graham and editor Ben Bradley. Reaching deep into the archives of my paper, The Times Union, we offer the real figures themselves, talking in 1996 on the occasion of the retirement of Harry Rosenfeld, who before his time in Albany served as the Post Washington Metro editor, where his notable hires included a young reporter named Bob Woodward.
One of Harry's greatest things was his hires and his feeling for talent. And let me tell the story of Bob Woodward, who I know is going to be on this because he was one of Harry's greatest hires.
Because I've always claimed that he was one of my greatest hires. Do we have to share that?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Because
I find that difficult, but
at
I'll
least
do it.
The story as I've heard it, you know it firsthand, so I defer to you. No. But, and certainly Bob will be able to speak for himself.
Yeah.
But the story as I heard it was that he came right out of the Navy and inexperienced and asked Harry for a job. And Harry thought that he was he hounded Harry so badly, as I understand it, that Harry had had him hired for 2 weeks. And at the end of 2 weeks, nothing Bob wrote had been printed. And so Harry said, Bob, you need experience. And he sent him off to the Montgomery County paper, where Bob went quietly, or not so quietly. And
not likely.
Pretty soon he began busting stories over the Post's head from Montgomery County. And then he began hounding Harry to come back. And Harry got a little impatient with Bob's calls. And one day he was at home painting his house, and Annie, his adorable wife, said, Harry, Bob's on the phone. And he said, I'm painting my house. I've been interrupted before. this is a pain. And as I understand it, Annie said, Harry, isn't this the kind of reporter you say you need and want? And so Harry said, you're right, and he got off the ladder and hired Bob.
So Annie gets the credit?
Yeah.
All right.
But Annie at the same time said to Harry, this is what you have told me you were looking for.
Yeah.
So
but it was, I
they
guess.
All get the credit and you get the credit.
Matt, what you really get in that is sort of the sense of the professional rapport between the two of them. They're clearly kind of a team.
For sure. It was a very casual conversation, almost like you were eavesdropping. It was a lot of fun to watch.
Bradley and Graham, unfortunately, are no longer with us. Mm-hmm. I'm very happy to say that Harry Rosenfeld still is raising hell in editorial boards left and right. All right, we leave you today with footage of ice skaters on the Empire State Plaza. I'm Casey Seiler.
And I'm Matt Ryan. Remember, if you missed any of this program, you can watch it all right now on NYNow.org. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time right here on your local PBS station.